Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And one of the things we were just covering on Friday was the executive orders. We're going to get back into where we left off. But before I do, I have to emphasize that debt is fraud. Hopefully, Trump will actually start dealing with that and actually start letting the world know, hey, you know what? We can't be spending this money. And the fact that you've been giving us money to spend on things we can't spend on, you know, you're more culpable than we are. You have the responsibility of doing the due diligence on an investment that what you're investing in is a legitimate investment. And who knew? Who knew? We've been lied to for well over a century. Anyway, I mean, this needs to play out because the whole world, the bankers and corrupt individuals in the United States, took this nation illegitimately and started doing things to literally create this facade. I mean, the bankruptcies we suffered from in the past were all illegitimate bankruptcies, and they use those bankruptcies to hurt you, to take away your property and so forth, to subjugate you. Whatever you think they're doing is legitimate, very little of what they're doing is legitimate, very little. So the other thing is, in your appeal to heaven, please consider letting me know if you have an open, you know, prayer or what have you, that we'll post it on Red State Talk Radio, or you can join Loud and Liberty. That's already up there. And your campaign begins today. You need to start campaigning in demanding compliance of the Constitution by both the citizens. You need to start recruiting citizens to get involved. You need to start holding public servants to be involved and actually start fulfilling their oath of office and calling those by using First Amendment petitions out to do so. The whole point of the First Amendment petition is a litmus test to determine, are they willing to actually support the Constitution? If they're not, then we need to demand their removal. And so lots of things happening. Hope you stay tuned and hope you keep track of what the heck's going on. Hopefully we have really good news, because I know that in Wyoming, the Federal Review Committee is being basically debated in committee today. And so we'll keep you apprised in how that goes. We expect this to actually pass. Now, here's the problem. And if you've ever watched the debates on the Convention of States, how is it that the Convention of States gets the ability to wrangle your state legislature in creating a whole committee to discuss, you know, this whole thing? I am just absolutely appalled that the Convention of States actually can take a whole day of time in grandstanding, when the reality is they're not addressing the problem. The Federal Review Committee will actually get, before the state legislature thinks that the Constitution is the problem, they need to perform a review. And as a matter of fact, I am just absolutely appalled that there's these conservative, you know, legislators in Montana, Utah, and all over the place that say, you know, the last thing we need is a constitutional convention, and offer no real tangible solution. I mean, they're almost culpable in causing this problem and creating a binary dialogue. So here's the question. If you live in any of these states, then you need to start demanding that your legislators stop the nonsense of debating something until they actually perform the audit. Because bottom line, we need to determine whether the Constitution is the problem or not. Does it really need an amendment? And I'm going to tell you right now that 98% of all of our problems are coming from violations of the Constitution. And so, you know, I'm going to reach out, because I know that Teresa Manzella has had her her problems. And as a matter of fact, because she's an ardent champion against the convention, she has been attacked in Montana. And so I'm kind of taking today to kind of, you know, help you understand how ludicrous this has all become. We've literally allowed ourselves to be A, B, or diametrically opposed over one particular issue when the real problem isn't diametric. In other words, it's not over that very particular issue on a convention. The fact is, until the legislatures actually perform the audit, like what Thomas Jefferson did for Kentucky, and actually audit, you know, what the heck's going on with the federal government and determine, are these things constitutional? Because if the outcome of the audit proves that 98% of what the federal government is doing is not constitutional, and they're not within the derived objects of the Constitution, then the Constitution's not the problem. The biggest problem is getting compliance to the Constitution. Ergo, that though, you know, Teresa Manzella needs to start championing the Federal Review Committee to actually establish the audit within their state, just like we're doing in Wyoming. And we've presented this bill. I don't know. I haven't heard from anybody in South Dakota because I know they've just been devastated with weather and so forth. And so over the past few months. And so I'm planning on connecting this week to find out, you know, what's going on and who's, you know, whether anybody is sponsoring, who's sponsoring the bill, because we've had the bill in South Dakota, I believe, for two years. So anyway, why is it that other states aren't doing this? Why is it that other states aren't saying, quit wasting our time, convention states, we're not doing this anymore, even though you've got a lot of people, and as a matter of fact, you need to slap down any of these legislators that allow themselves to be, you know, coerced or even, you know, brainwashed into thinking that we need a convention. The dialogue must be this, that the campaign begins today on compliance of the Constitution. And this review committee at the county, in Stevens County, they're doing this. And we hope to have other counties within Iowa, within all sorts of states in the next year, actually starting to form. We hope to actually have a whole, isn't this funny? Washington State, a blue state, is actually forming the audit and the committee to do this in a county. Not one county in Montana, not one county in Idaho, not one county in Utah, not one county in a dark red state. It's starting first in a blue state. Come on, red states, wake up and start doing your job. Start actualizing the problem. You cannot fix a problem until you actualize it. You have to understand the details of the causes and how this problem is persisting. And how it's growing. And if you do that, you will find that this is strictly usurpations. This is strictly violations of the Constitution. It's that simple, folks. It's that simple. But anyway, anywho, so your campaign begins today. And so one of the things that we had been diving into is Trump's, let's say, his executive orders, but he's doing this wrong. And in some cases, he's trying to legislate or what have you, and he doesn't have that power. As a matter of fact, his executive orders need to start off with that the Constitution was designed with clear separations of powers. And the real problem has come where the courts have violated the separations of power. Another thing he needs to add into his executive orders, if the problems has come from the Congress, then if he's trying to fix a congressional problem, because 9 times out of 10, those congressional problems are usurpations. In other words, they created an act that was not derived from any grants or any powers granted. No delegations, no enumerations within the Constitution. And so... on this immigration thing, is the federal government responsible? Do they have the power to regulate immigration? And the real answer to that question is no. And this is why we have to go into the Constitution to identify where is the word immigration even listed in the Constitution? Because, again, in the very beginning, people immigrated to the states. there was not one person that, you know, got off the docks of Washington, D.C. and says, I want to be a citizen of Washington, D.C. I want to come. Now, there were lobbyists and there are foreign, you know, ministers and those types of beings, those types of cases where people would actually go to D.C. because they had business there. D.C. was not to be a state. You didn't immigrate to D.C. You went there to do business. And as a matter of fact, we talk about this whole thing, this whole facade, that D.C. is trying to make itself into a state when it was specifically denied to be in a state, which is why Congress had exclusive legislative authority over it. Only it. They don't even have really exclusive legislation over the territory other than those needful rules and regulations to help transition it to become a state. That's right there in Article 4. It is not within the enumerated powers of Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8 is the only place where Congress has been granted to say you can create laws to do these things, which is why the Necessary and Proper Clause was at the very beginning. And as a matter of fact, they even entertained the concept of adding to each line, and they realized it would be redundant when they actually went into the Constitution. And I'll give you a case in point, because if you look at Article 1, Section 8, and you actually go, okay, Congress have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States and how and shall have the, and what is the Necessary and Proper Clause? How does that go? And they shall make the laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution this power. And then they say the same thing after the second power, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and within the Indian tribes and shall make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution this law or this power. Does that make sense? This is why they put it at the end, and through the ratification of Bates, they spelt this out. They spelt it out, which is why in the Necessary and Proper Clause, they mention the execution, carrying into execution the foregoing powers. This was not a new power or a general power being granted. They literally went through and defined this. Okay, so in the enumerated objects that Congress can make laws, and as a matter of fact, there were restrictions. Now, we need to give you the restriction because Congress could not meddle with the importation of persons. And this is exactly what it says. The migration or importation of persons as the states, as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808. But a duty or tax may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 a person. In other words, they couldn't create laws to prohibit states from migrations and or importations of persons. Now, I want you to understand this. This did not give them the authority over immigration. The immigration was basically going into the states. So the states should have actually had control over how many people and what those people were going to do and so forth. Because if they wanted to open their arms to a bunch of laborers to work in the fields, then they could say, well, this is the kind of people we're interested in. Don't come here if we're not interested in that. And actually, by the citizen standards, a state could deny, if a person tried to come in and say, we told you not to come here, we're denying you citizenship of this state. When a person receives a felony, and or when they've basically been stripped of their citizenship or denied their citizenship, they can no longer be a citizen in the United States. That's the control the states have. Because the United States, a United States citizen grants them, if that person can go to another state and actually become a U.S. citizen, be forgiven by another state of their felony or the crime and the punishment that came from that, then that would actually be an atrocity of the law. Because no state can deny another state its standing. Now, a state could allow it to become, that person could become a citizen of their state. That person could leave and become a citizen of that other state. But to vote in U.S. Elections and so forth, they have to become a U.S. citizen. And when a state denies a person citizenship to their state, in other words, they're taking it, they're stripping you your citizenship because of a felony, or for whatever reason, they're not going to grant you access because you migrated there, you cannot become a citizen. So in essence, when they report this to the federal government or to the general government, then, and another state says, hey, this person's wanting to become a citizen of the United States, they should have a database. They should have a record of who's been denied, because when a state legislature, and if it comes up that a person comes back into the state claiming to be a U.S. citizen when they've denied them, they can actually say, you can't be a U.S. citizen. We've denied you citizen of this state. And in so doing that, because becoming a U.S. citizen basically means you become a citizen of all states. You can literally move from one state to another and be a citizen of that state. You're entitled to be a citizen of that state, which is why the federal government couldn't control that process. But in Article 1, Section 10, this is the power that they had. They had the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization of how this was to happen, how people would become citizens. But they couldn't, and they were not involved in the importation of people or the immigration of people. Their responsibility was to protect the states from invasions, from insurrections, and they were responsible for executing the federal law, which is why the militia is the only entity that has the authority to execute the law, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. Now, that can be done at the state level. They don't need the federal government to federalize the militia within your state unless the state is so overwhelmed. Like, look at what's going on in the southern border. And because no state has a militia, or I should say, no state has an acting militia today that can be federalized, because the federal government, through an unconstitutional act called the 1903 Dick Act, actually reached in and stripped them of their ability to defend themselves. And so this is why I start this all off with, this is all a facade. What we're dealing with in our government is not legitimate. There are very few legitimate things that they are doing, but the majority of everything they're doing is illegitimate, which is why we started this whole thing off. And I really, and before I even got into the Trump executive order, I mentioned, you know, this whole dialogue, this wasted time dialogue in allowing two sides, the conventionites and the anti-conventionites, to think that that's the only option. That's the only door to go through. We've proven to you that there are seven paths. There are seven paths that people have laid out that, oh, well, this is the way. And we've proven that every path except for one actually deals with the problem. The courts cannot deal with the problem. The courts will refuse to actually fix the problem, because the courts would actually have to surrender. They'd have to cut off their arms. And it is antithetical to survival for a being to do that. Only when, and they will cut off the one arm, they will not cut off all their arms and legs. I mean, other than the fact if it is actually ultimately required by their survival. And I'm thinking, and I'm telling you, that Trump needs to weaponize the Department of Justice and retool them completely. Get rid of everybody and bring everybody in that are going to be ardent supporters of the oath of office of the Constitution, and making sure that every person that has taken a public oath, or I should say the oath as a public servant, to support and defend that Constitution and obey it in the state of Wyoming, because they actually do all three, support, defend, and obey. But those folks that are actually under the legal oath to support the Constitution must be held accountable to supporting it. Because those who are not supporting it and doing other things and making political compromises and blah, 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 they need to be removed, especially those who are nefariously doing this. It's one thing that we have a lot of ignorant people involved. There's a lot of people that do not know what they're doing. And those people, they might deserve a first and final to say, hey, you can't do this anymore. You have to make sure that everything you're doing, every bill that is coming up on that floor, is a constitutional bill. If it is a bill that would actually support the violations of the Constitution by the federal government and other governments, or I should say, other things that the state government is doing that would be violating that. And I'll give you a good example. Voter initiatives. Voter initiatives are being done by the states, and it violates a Republican form of government, allowing the people to create their own laws. A Republican form of government means we have legislators, and as a matter of fact, we go through this all the time. Our form of republicanism is that we represent sovereigns, not just the people. When the people create a government, that government is actually has suffrage in the Senate. This is why the Senate represents the state legislatures. And to this day, they're legally obligated to do that in accordance with Article 5. You know, if state legislators listen to this show, if your state legislators listen to this show, you would start seeing real changes in your state and their laws. Because state legislatures would start standing up every time a bill came across that would have any inkling or any fingers touching the violations and crossing those barriers of the Constitution. And they would point their finger at the person that wrote that bill and brought it forward and say, do you realize you are violating your oath by bringing a bill onto this floor that directly violates the Constitution? I'll give you a case in point. The digital currency bill. The digital currency bill would be a direct violation of the Constitution, and it should never have been brought to the floor in any of the state houses. Every member of the LSOs, or the legal teams that actually vet all of these bills, every member that is a part of that, they should all be fired and removed. And as a matter of fact, the state legislature has the responsibility. They're the ones that actually have to bear the brunt of the consequences because the sponsor and everybody who voted for it needs to be removed. Because Article 1, Section 10 forbids the states from passing any law that allows anything other than gold and silver to be the payment for the or legal tender for the payment of debt. And so... If state legislators really started listening to this, then this is not hard to be compliant. And as a matter of fact, now's the time because you could almost stand up almost every bill and say, this bill violates the Constitution. When are we going to get serious? When are we going to stop basically killing ourselves and our citizens? We're destroying our state and our citizenry by allowing this tyranny to be waged against us. Folks, look up at the sky and look at the chemtrails and the spraying that they're doing. That's direct warfare. That is not good for your health, putting heavy metals in our water system and into our bodies. That is not good. So, back to the immigration, though. There is nowhere, because right there in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 3, Congress has the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. There's nowhere in here where they have any migration at all, other than the restriction about making laws against the states from doing it. So it's one thing if a state gets started carried away. Let's just say a state started just allowing themselves to be overran, and they said, we're not going to stop this. And they allowed themselves to be overran by illegals from the southern border or from the northern border. Let's just play with the northern border. Montana allowed all of the Canadians to cross their line and became a sanctuary state for Canadians. And the other state said, hey, this is a real problem. That, you know, these people are actually coming in to compete for, you know, white collar jobs and so forth. And they're basically, Montana is becoming the funnel for that. The federal government does have the power to, because they can actually stop states from actually allowing and importing these, or allowing the immigration of people, because it says right there in Article 1, Section 9, that the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to 1808. So now they can actually make laws and say, you can't do that. You have to basically stay within these realms so that you can't overrun us and actually start controlling those things. We'll be right back after this quick break.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's just be clear. A migration of anything, animals, a migration of people, is people that are just crossing the border without immigrating. Immigration is a controlled process. Immigration is when one person actually goes to, and for some reason, the federal government became the central point on this. And we can get into this because when we look in 1868, it is very well known. After the 14th Amendment and after its ratification, even afterwards, the federal government had no immigration policies. It was still left with the states. No immigration policies after the 14th Amendment. And today, they control all immigration. They weren't supposed to. That's not their job. And the fact that they created an immigration, and in some ways, I can see how the states kind of allowed that little transgression to let the federal government kind of centrally kind of control that. I can see that. And I can see them actually amending the Constitution, possibly, to do that. But I would be very apprehensive in giving them that power because they've only proven that they'll use it as a tool and warfare against us. So when we really look at what happens, now let's go back to Montana allowing these evil Canadians, these white-collar Canadians, these laborers, not blue-collar field, type, or I should say, so you got blue-collar labor. So there may be some blue-collar, but not migrant field workers, real manual labor. And so what we have is Montana has started creating this funnel of these aliens to come in, and they're allowing all of this. And again, they've created a uniform rule of naturalization, but they recognize that Montana is creating a condition of an invasion to where other states are actually being overran in their labor departments by these acts of migrating people. Technically, the federal government in Article 4, Section 4 has the responsibility of repelling invasions. So it's one thing if Montana is allowing the immigration of people, but if they're allowing just people to come across the border because good white collar jobs and blue technical skills and those types of things are available and they can come down here and work on diesel engine, whatever, then, and they're just allowing them to come in without immigrating because they know they have a friendly policy for laborers that want to get into America, then that would be considered an invasion, and the federal government has the power in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14 to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the unit or suppress insurrection, and in this case, repel invasions. And Article 4, Section 4 guarantees that the federal government will protect other states from an invasion that is occurring in a different state. In other words, now that Montana is allowing this invasion, they can call forth a militia of other states to start actually grabbing the people that have come from Canada and deport them and deploy militia into Montana and secure that border and basically go after, because bottom line, if they're allowing an invasion, then the people in office of that state must be removed because they're allowing an insurrection by allowing an invasion. And so when you really look at the, you know, when you look at the design of our Constitution, the states and the people have so much more power. The federal government is to protect us from states going rogue like Montana in this particular case. And I know there's a lot of people in Montana would think I'm just picking on them. And I'm not. I'm just trying to use these examples because, you know, we see this invasion on the southern border happening in New Mexico. You know, it's happening in Texas because Texas is just that big. It's happening in Arizona, but I can tell you in Texas and Arizona, they're trying to fight this. And in California, they're doing everything they can to allow it. And in New Mexico, they're doing everything. So those two states need to be cleaned up within the state government and the local governments. Anybody that's allowing these things and basically pushing back and creating sanctuary statuses, when you've created a sanctuary status where you don't care about the law, just come here, then those people are actually performing an insurrection against the Constitution. We've read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment time and time again. They do not deserve, they do not get, Section 3 does not give a public servant due process. You have been determined, and it has been clearly proven that you have violated your oath of office and failed to support the Constitution. Failed to support. What does that mean? Well, when all of these people had voted for the digital currency, but not one legislator in that state house stood up and said, you have just violated your oath and you all must be removed. The person that does that has exonerated themselves from actually giving aid and comfort to the enemy. If you do nothing and you allow those bills to go forward without actually stating something and then calling them out for violating their oath, now you're supporting the Constitution. You do nothing, and that is tantamount to aid and comfort. Madison was clear in the Kentucky or the Virginia resolutions that state legislators must oppose every infraction, every infraction. They can't cherry pick, well, you know, this is really a good idea. It's an infraction nonetheless. Now, I have talked about the difficulty of doing the right thing, like what James Monroe did. There are times when we've actually had the circumstance where the federal government didn't have the power to do it, and James Monroe violated his oath. And the states really, because they were so disconnected from the federal government, they weren't aware of these things happening until well after the fact. Because they didn't have this wired network and this, you know, instant access like we have today. This speaks to the importance of not, I don't care about the 17th Amendment. This speaks to the necessity of direct suffrage of the state legislature with the Senate of the United States within Congress. Because Article 5 protects the fact that they cannot be denied their suffrage in the Senate without their consent. The 17th Amendment did not give consent. If they ratified the 17th Amendment, that was not giving consent to losing their suffrage. It only changed the mechanism of how the representatives for the state legislature were to be chosen. It just changed. That's all. It did not address Article 5 and the suffrage in the Senate. And so any legislator that's hearing this today, you need to actually bring this up as as a bomb in your state legislature. Because reading Article 5 and the concept of your suffrage in that Senate means that the 17th Amendment did not address that in changing the Constitution. It only changed Article 1 and the process of the selection of a senator. That's it. And so when your representatives in the Senate are actually voting for globalism and voting poorly, you can have every single one of them recalled. Because when you tell them not to vote that way and to vote this way, because the reason why the states couldn't actually get really pissed off at their senators is because they didn't have direct access like we do today. And this is why I've presented this idea. I know that this is really out there, but we live in an electronic age. Why is it that the state legislatures aren't actually voting on those issues? In other words, it's pretty easy. They have a consensus and they say, yes, we'll allow this person to be the next Supreme Court justice instead of even having a Senate. Right? Now, I want you to understand that it's all probably imperative to have a proxy, a single proxy, so that each state, if they can't give their vote in the Senate because a bad weather situation or something like that, when the time comes, that proxy already knows how they're voting and what to do. And they will deliver the state suffrage in that vote when it happens. So in other words, they'll be there, but they're not senators anymore. They're literally just proxy people that have been appointed by the state legislature to sit in D.C. and basically get a stipend of pay to be there. That's it. That's what we could do in actually taking back that whole control of that side of Congress. How, if you looked at how many states would actually take back the color of the Senate would dramatically turn red. Now, I would say that because they would be strong, because it would basically be the redness of the state legislatures your problem. Your problem regarding the state legislatures are that there's way too many rhinos. In other words, the state legislatures have actually been polluted and perverted by these people who are actually liberals that run under Republican names. So the this goes into the party having the real contribution in the problem. If we could get every party in the United States to do what Wyoming is doing and actually promoting full compliance with the Constitution and holding their public servants accountable to their oath, when we start going down this path of accountability, everything cleans up. When we can actually hold them accountable, because the law demands it, by the way, folks. Don't think that if we had this magical thing, we don't have to have a magical thing. The Constitution demands that every public servant who violates their oath must be removed. The problem is the party does not have any mechanisms because the state legislatures have protected themselves from the party from being able to do anything. So what kind of form of government do we have? I go back to the point that we actually have a democratic form of government. We have a corporate form of government. We have a judiciary form of government. We have a party form of government. We have every form of government except for a Republican form of government. Because the way we're being ruled and the way we're being constrained from having the government that we want, the corporations, the judges, the party, and or corporations, party, the judiciary. What was the fourth one? I know the executive. Anyway, we have every form of government except for Republican. And the only way to get it back and the only way to maintain a Republican form of government is by compliance to the law. Going back to, because the whole point was to get into to Trump's knickers today. The whole point is that Trump needs to use the separations of power that is designed within the Constitution and calling out both the judiciary for overreach and supporting these things and using the separations of power, or I should say the enumerations of power on Congress when Congress is doing something that's not enumerated within the Constitution. So in other words, the Civil Rights Act, or I should not the Civil Rights Act, the Immigration Act of 1965 was unconstitutional. Any act regarding immigration, the only act that Congress can pass that would actually have a teeth to it, legislative power in the states, are any laws that are referring to a uniform rule of naturalization. Anything regarding immigration is not an enumerated object. It is not enumerated. And I think it's been a godsend that it was not enumerated and that we never did amend the Constitution back in the 1800s when they started getting overrun in early 1900s when all sorts of people started coming to the United States and creating this surge of people where they had to create Ellis Island and these types of conditions where the federal government stepped in. I'm so glad that the states didn't think, hey, let's amend the Constitution. Because we can take it all back. If it hasn't been properly done, it is a violation and there are no statute of limitations in the Constitution granting the federal government pure anonymity so that they can get away with doing whatever they want as long as they can get away with it for 20 years. Oh, we did it for 20 years now, and now you caught us, but it's too late. It's legitimate now because there's that clause in the Constitution that allows the statute of limitations to pass, and now it becomes legitimate. And so we're going to go ahead and modify the Constitution now. And actually, when you think about it, the annotated Constitution is precisely that, but they actually are changing this thing at breakneck speed. This is one of the reasons why I'm really honed today, more focused on the state legislatures and the fact that they're not holding their selves accountable, and they're not holding the federal government accountable. Their suffrage in the Senate, they're not holding the Supreme Court, the president. They need to start holding the entire federal government accountable. And this is why we go through these documents to prove that the states actually have this power. They are the parties to the compact. And there is no, as Madison stated, there is no tribunal greater than the parties to the compact when no other tribunal exists over those things not delegated. Remember, the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary, their jurisdiction is limited, and it is specifically limited to all things arising under this Constitution. Now, we'll get into the 11th Amendment and all of that regarding, you know, how they kind of changed that, because this is why I'm diving into the ratification debates on that particular issue, because you got to remember that the 11th Amendment actually took the last part of Section 2, that paragraph that said, you know, you cannot construe, you know, federal jurisdiction at all between a person and another state and or foreign citizen, something like that. I mean, that basically covers that last part of that paragraph of jurisdiction. Okay, so let me get back into this whole thing, because post-Civil War reforms focused on injustices to African Americans. The 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868 to protect the rights of native-born Black Americans whose rights were being denied, and actually these people were being killed that they were trying to stand up and get active in politics. Don't forget, and I will not let you forget, the massacre of 1868 in New Orleans, where 200 Black freedmen were actually massacred by law keepers and men of the party at that point in time, because Blacks were actually going to challenge them in the polls and actually a good chance of becoming the next representatives of the people in Louisiana. Do not think for a minute that the states weren't the problem. Typically, the states have, when we look at the magnitude of the problem from the very beginning and so forth, the reason we've got this federal government overreach and everything else, because the states have failed to do it, and actually they've taken the money every time the federal government's come along, hey, we've got an offer you can't receive, and here's a bunch of money that lets you do it. Anyway, so an unintended consequence of this particular defining a citizen that the 14th Amendment did, you know, defining a U.S. citizen, it also applied to Indians. Its intention was to prevent state governments from ever denying citizenship to Blacks born in the United States under the jurisdiction, because the language was clear. It basically said if you, your parents were born in the United States and under the jurisdiction of the federal government, then they are and you are U.S. citizens. And how is it that Indians that are on Indian reservations or born within a state that is under the federal jurisdiction does not become a citizen? This is much broader than that. And I'm telling you, this has been very divisive, and there's nobody better than the devil in being divisive and creating contention. The fact is, when we look at the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, we look at the ratification debates and so forth, the concept of people coming here without immigrating, they're just sneaking in and trying to legitimize themselves. That is an invasion. They recognize those types of invasions not just as military invasions, cultural invasions, political invasions. There are different types of opposing forces that can actually attack America in different ways. It doesn't have to be military. That's why the term invasion was a generic invasion in the Constitution, because they actually talked about people coming here and overtaking the laws and assuming their statuses and so forth, that they could change our culture and our laws and overtake us. They knew this because this had actually happened, and they pointed to the Mohammedans in doing this. So, and as a matter of fact, the framers were very well aware, and in our invasion petition, Petition 3, I identify the name of the doctrine in the Hadith that is practiced by Mohammedans in invading a country. Okay, so again, in 1868, after the ratification of the Constitution, the United States had no formal immigration policy. It was not an enumerated object, which is why they had no policy. It was not enumerated. Only a uniform rule of naturalization, which is why they actually kept up on that. So, moving forward, as we kind of look at the 14th Amendment, this is really important. Senator Jacob Howard worked very closely with Abraham Lincoln, drafting and passing the 13th Amendment to the United States. Technically, that was the 14th Amendment, but right now, because we've obscured and obviated the original 13th, we'll just say the 13th. But I'm telling you folks, there are 28 amendments that have been actually ratified. We've got documentation to prove this. But again, Senator Howard, also served on the Senate Joint Committee on Reconstruction, which drafted the 14th Amendment. And actually, I want to be clear here, before even the 14th Amendment, he was involved in drafting the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And they passed it. The Civil Rights Act was passed, and lo and behold, it was vetoed. And Johnson basically said, "It doesn't matter if you overpower my veto." Basically, he poked him in the eye. And President Johnson said, "Hey, it doesn't matter if you overpower my veto, because this is an act, and acts are not enforceable in the states. You have to amend the Constitution." And ergo, instead of overchanging the Civil Rights Act by overpowering that act, and then, because only those types of acts that are passive, because they're not enumerated within the Constitution, they're only applicable in the District of Columbia and within territories. In other words, if it's not a state, the federal government cannot inflict those types of laws because they're not constitutional. Ergo, instead of overcoming the veto, what they did was they did the right thing. And they actually passed, by two-thirds of both houses, an amendment and said, "To heck with you, President Johnson. This is going to the states. You can't veto this." And ergo, they went out to the states with the 14th Amendment, and they integrated these parts. And as I told you on Friday, it wasn't until a month later that Howard actually wanted to inject and make sure that this was addressed, because of the Dred Scott ruling that created this unconstitutional law. Again, this Dred Scott and that ruling by the Taney Court created law, and they have no legal authority to create law. The federal court cannot create law. Legislative power is vested in Congress and Congress only. There is no amendment to the Constitution to allow the courts to create law. So again, when President Trump is doing these executive orders, he needs to be very focused on how these things are violations, how the court and first off, how the Congress was passing laws that were not enumerated, and these laws are not effective to the states. And secondly, that the courts cannot create laws either. So, because the only laws that are in pursuance to the Constitution will come from Congress, and those laws will be derivatives of the enumerated objects in Article 1, Section 8, period. And this is exactly what Madison was saying when they were trying to pass the bank acts and all these other types of things that were violations of the Constitution. Madison was right 100% of the time, every step of the way. He was one of the very few men that never thought it was prudent to ever allow a violation. And as a matter of fact, when we look at what he did, I mean, the fact that he never once referenced the Federalist Papers, never once said, hey, go to the Federalist Papers. Let's look at what the Federalist Papers said. Every time it was in debate in Congress, he pointed to the ratification debates. Why is that? Because the Federalist Papers were just arbitrary editorials in a newspaper, had no legal standing. But the ratification debates were the terms and definitions provided by the proponents for the Constitution in helping sell and ratify that compact. Ergo, they are legally binding terms and definitions. And nobody wants you to know this. And every lawyer will squeal like a pig if you point these things out. And they will deny it and they will attack you. Isn't that interesting? Now they start, now that we actually have a solid footing on the real law of the land, of the Constitution and its terms and definitions, and why having these committees are so critical. Now that you can start understanding, I believe these committees could actually help the Trump administration. I will tell you that the first committee formed will actually be able to provide guidance to the Trump administration in their findings to say these things are unconstitutional. Because they will actually create the legitimate Constitution and they will actually create the legitimate foundation, the terms and definitions of that Constitution. Ergo, it takes away even this idea or concept of interpretation that the courts are bound by the definitions provided. If there are no definitions provided, the court must actually seek guidance from those of the authority to give them the guidance. In other words, the parties, not Congress. Congress only had the ability to determine and decide and define those things that were granted to them. The federal courts had no ability to determine what they were to do and so forth. It was actually to Congress's discretion, and that's never changed. Except in 1835, Congress just said, well, go ahead and, you know, rule yourself. That's okay. Even though the Constitution tells us we have to do it, we'll let you do it by yourself. And that's how one of the bad worms got out of the box. Anyway, I've got less than a minute left. The bottom line is, folks, when we look at these, when we look at each of the EOs that Trump is doing, they're actually suspect. There's going to be problems. And bottom line, until you actually say you can't come from the court and stop this, it is your obligation to support the Constitution. Ergo, when Washington State and these other states start suing Trump like they did in his first term, that he can actually shut them down, period. I mean, when you're standing on the Constitution and you're standing on its true definitions and terms and so forth, when you're standing on the truth of the Constitution, you can't be knocked down. So the question is, does Trump want to continue taking the political latitude of not standing on the Constitution and fight these fights, or does he want to actually make America great? Because the only way you can do that is by standing on the Constitution and demanding compliance and actually removing every judge that refuses to comply and every governor, everybody that refuses to comply to the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.